You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 5, Q&A 3, or Bolaño's Crime Novels, A Yen for Magic, and Magic Weaponized. Today I'm recording from Santiago, Chile. Let's just jump right into the questions here. Now, you'll be proud of me. I got through 2 whole questions last time. Let's see if we can get 2 questions this time. Now, for the most part, I will go in order, but if a question is, I wouldn't say easy, but I might answer questions out of order if, you know, it doesn't require a lot of work, like this one. So, we have a question from Tony. Tony asks, I read online that you talk about 2666 in an episode. Which one? I kind of remember saying this on Twitter, and I was doing something that I always disliked when other podcasters would do this. I was referring to an episode that I have recorded but not yet released. It's understandable why it happens, but I never liked it, and nevertheless, here I am doing it myself. Basically, in the free episode 26, which has yet to come out, I discuss the parallels between the Nazi policy Nacht und Nebel, and I compare that to the forced disappearances, the practice of desaparecidos. In that episode, I speculate that expat Nazis taught it to Latin American security forces as a counterinsurgency tactic. There's a real possibility that this is one of the reasons why there are so many femicides in Ciudad Juárez, of which Roberto Bolaño wrote in the novel 2666. Now for me, there's nobody better than Bolaño, and I am comparing him to Thomas Pynchon or any number of novelists which I also love and haven't talked about yet. I've read all of Bolaño's essays, stories, and novels, some of them twice and some of them in Spanish. I've even read his poetry in Spanish. Most of his actual views on society are occulted in his writings, but I would say that I am in agreement with Bolaño on a great many number of things, and I resonate with his work on a spiritual level. If I had to make anyone read just a single work by Roberto Bolaño, as an introduction anyway, I would probably pick By Night in Chile. This is not to say that people shouldn't read Nazi Literature in the Americas, one of the funniest books I've ever read, or The Savage Detectives, or 2666, or literally everything else. But By Night in Chile is a short, concise introduction to Bolaño, and I consider it nearly perfect as a literary work. And seriously, it's like 144 pages of novel writing. It's not dense, quite short, goes real quick. Now, if I might be allowed to talk about By Night in Chile for a minute, please allow me. Bolaño is not really the type of writer for whom spoilers matter that much. I mean, speaking generally. But if you haven't read it and you care about spoilers, skip ahead a couple minutes. By Night in Chile is structured as the hallucinations and reminiscences of a man in Chile named Father Urrutia. Since this is on the premium side, my dear listeners, my serial chillers, it's time to give a confession. I cannot roll my R's. I am a unreconstructed gringo who never could get the hang of it. Just know that it's a double R in his name. I think it's Bosque. But Father Urrutia, this priest, he's dying, and he's having deathbed memories, right? In his life, Father Urrutia was a priest with literary pretensions who interacted with various real and fictional literary figures in Latin America. For instance, there's a amazing dinner party where he happens to meet Pablo Neruda, and the rest of the dinner party is, I guess you could say, unforgettable. Now, much of the novel is Father Urrutia's attempts at self-justification, undermined by his own honesty. In particular, he's haunted by a youth who condemns him, which could be any of the youth of Chile who demanded to know why Father Urrutia's generation, why the Catholic Church, why the entire country stood by while such horrors were occurring under the Pinochet dictatorship. There's also the strong possibility that the youth that's condemning Father Urrutia and tormenting him could either be Arturo Bolaño or Ulises Lima, who are both recurring characters in Bolaño's extended universe. Bolaño, in particular, is a fictionalized version of Bolaño himself, and I believe those characters appear in The Savage Detectives and 2666. I believe some others, I can't recall off the top of my head. Then, in the course of his life, Father Urrutia is given a fellowship to travel to Europe. He gets recruited by a shipping company to write a report on the preservation of churches, which is to say, to go over to Europe and research how to stop the literal physical deterioration of Catholic churches from damage by birds, specifically bird shit, in other words. There's a heavy implication that this trip is cover to go interact with various far-right forces in Europe. Now, in Europe, Father Urrutia interacts with Opus Dei, and he meets with various priests engaged in falconry in order to solve this bird shit problem afflicting Catholic churches. There's a major plot point that bird shit slowly erodes buildings, especially ancient buildings like churches, and that the Catholic Church was fighting this through falconry. Now, fascists have always used falcon imagery, and of course there's Operation Condor, which was the CIA-ran program of assassinations of leftists carried out by the security forces of right-wing dictatorships in the southern cone of Latin America. And, in the course of the novel, Pinochet comes to power in the course of Father Urrutia's life, right? And in keeping with this theme, the Pinochet regime had a penchant for dropping leftists out of airplanes and helicopters, which is a very falcon-like thing to do. I'm belaboring the symbolism in the novel. It's quite subtle when you actually read it. Bolaño, master of the anecdote within the novel, includes in Father Urrutia's haunted memory the story of some literary aesthetes in Chile who were hanging out in some rich woman's salon. And this anecdote is set sometime after Pinochet's dictatorship came into power. And so they were having this literary party, right? And one poet drunkenly wandered into the basement of this rich woman's house. And he finds out, accidentally, that this rich woman's husband works for DINA, which is to say, Dirección de Inteligencia Nacional, which was the Chilean secret police. And this poet realizes that they were actually torturing leftists in the basement while these literary parties were occurring. Now this story, I believe Roberto Bolaño swears that it actually occurred, though some people have questioned whether this is actually true. It's probably literally impossible to disprove it, but needless to say, there's also not proof that it happened. Either way, this is a potent metaphor for Chilean history, and I think that it works as a scene in the novel very well. Later in the novel, Father Urrutia gets contracted to give lessons in Marxism to Pinochet and several top Chilean generals in scenes that I would call surreally comical yet horrifying. The last lines of the novel are burned in my skull. I will read the final paragraph or so, which is more or less Father Urrutia's final thoughts as he dies. And then I ask myself, where is the wizened youth? Why has he gone away? And little by little, the truth begins to rise like a dead body. A dead body rising from the bottom of the sea or from the bottom of a gully. I can see its shadow rising, its flickering shadow, its shadow rising as if it were climbing a hill on a fossil planet. And then, in the half-light of my sickness, I see his fierce, his gentle face, and I ask myself, am I that wizened youth? Is that the true, the supreme terror? to discover that I am the wizened youth whose cries no one can hear, and that the poor wizened youth is me. And then faces flash before my eyes at a vertiginous speed. The faces I admired, those I loved, hated, envied, and despised. The faces I protected, those I attacked. The faces I hardened myself against, and those I saw in vain. And then the storm of shit begins. And then the storm of shit begins. Beautiful. Now, the legendary French crime author Jean-Patrick Manchet, also a beloved author for me, he called crime novels the great moral literature of our time. And I completely agree with that. That's why Bolaño's recurring obsession with crime, even play-acting as detective, strikes me as the only resort for honest Latin American leftists dedicated to making good art. And, of course, I get the impulse myself. I am basically play-acting as a spy, or at least as an analyst, for many of the same reasons. Also, as a side note here, if you like Roberto Bolaño, or you like to hear about literary, content, let me know. I used to be a real pretentious literary type of dude. I wasn't really planning on doing any of that for the show unless requested. And that's true for a lot of topics. If you want to hear about something, let me know, whether in the Q&A section or not. I will either cover it or cover something related or explain why I won't. But usually it'll be the first two.
Thank you.
O'Sheen asks kind of a broad one, but to what extent do you believe in the material functioning of magic in the real world? And do you find the evidence persuasive to suggest that the ruling class or elements of the ruling class practice magic up to the present day? It's a great question, by the way. So I'm going to answer the first question, and then I will answer the second question. Do I believe in the material functioning of magic in the real world? Unequivocally, yes. Though I do not believe that magic works in necessarily the way the average person on the street might think that it does. You know what I'm saying? I think that magic is a much more subtle phenomenon, but I still think it's quite real. Man, these are good questions. I'm being outed as a unrepentant believer in magic, though I don't practice it in the sense that most people think. Let me get into it. To answer these questions, I'm probably going to have to sincere post for a minute. I was raised in a religious tradition. I was raised Mormon, to be precise.
Mystery Mormons.
And trust me, I know about Mormonism. Don't DM me thinking that I don't know some esoteric angle to it. I've studied it quite a bit. I will cover Mormonism over time. I do have plans to do so. So don't start clacking away trying to tell me about it, okay? But I will say this. By and large, I still hold to those beliefs. And no, I am not proselyting or apologizing for them in this show. You know, I'm just not interested in doing that. There is a lot to unpack with Mormonism and quite a bit of problematic shit. I already know, don't worry, we'll get to it. But I believe in most religions, and I believe in the dichotomy between white and black magic. For a really long time, I used to put a lot of caveats around these things, but I'm old enough now to just say them without hand-wringing about how it will come across. And I'm pretty sure that even if you don't agree, you know, your premium subscribers, dear listeners, serial chillers, I think you know where I'm coming from, so I'm not too worried about you guys. But let's get into some of this stuff. Let's really chew on it. What is magic? I don't see why we shouldn't use Aleister Crowley's definition, at least to introduce the topic. Crowley says, magic is the science and art that provokes change in conformity with will. He also said that all intentional acts are acts of magic. Now, that would definitely be too broad of a definition for skeptics, and we can certainly argue over definitions, but if that's the conception of magic that he had, then why, I mean, that's broad enough that, you know, that's broad enough to satisfy reasonably skeptical people, right? I think things like fasting, praying, religious rituals, use of icons and images, certain clothing, ablutions, all these different things that religions do, they are all magic too, white magic. Or maybe more precisely, they are things that are meant to effect magical changes, right? Doing them isn't necessarily magic, but like, you do them to get certain effects, and doing that to get the effect is magic, right? And one of the key components to white magic, at least as I see it, and mind you, I am not a scholar of magic, though I do study it quite a bit, is white magic is focused on trying to bring yourself in with the divine's will, whatever that might be, generally God or something to that effect. And it's my opinion that that's much healthier than other types of magic, right? You're generally on safer ground and you won't usually get into dangerous territory, right? Now, a broad definition of black magic generally says that it is the use of supernatural powers or magic for evil and or selfish purposes. Though some people assert that the core of black magic is contacting non-human entities, something which white magic usually does not do. Usually, contacting non-human entities is done in order to accomplish some specific aim, which some people argue is itself evil or selfish, though not necessarily, right? There are not hard, fast lines, you know. There's a lot of gray area with all of this stuff, right? Separate from that, a lot of people get hung up on magic like it's gotta work like X-Men superpowers or something like Harry Potter for it to be considered magic. I don't agree. I kind of view magic almost like a romantic date where you maybe have flowers and candles and soft music, a nice dinner, all of that. So much of magic, whether black or white magic, is making the right conditions and set of circumstances for something specific to happen. Is that really so different from doing all that on a date in order to try to get lucky? Or, to use a different metaphor, if you're cooking, it's not cheating to try and control as many variables in the process as you can by learning how different ingredients react in the whole cooking process, right? Like, no one would say that knowing that you need to grease a pan before you, you know, start cooking is like, that's not cheating to know how cooking works. And I think you could argue that magic is trying to find these correspondences. So if you make the right conditions for a certain thing to happen, it is more likely to happen. And a lot of magic is trying to tap into certain correspondences which may or may not have a basis in scientific laws that we don't understand yet. Even stage magic is still based on a lot of this stuff, because a lot of stage magic is just very small little tricks that work, whether or not you want to call them magic. Whether they're psychological, whether they're setting the stage, getting crowd, audience, you know, to believe you, to follow you with certain energy. Stage magic works if you define working as people being amazed and, you know, playing along, right? Now, I'm not a scholar of magic, I've mentioned. I've read a fair amount about it. I'm sure that real magicians might quibble with, you know, some of what I've said, but I don't think that I've been too far off the mark. But this is all definitional, you know. Maybe I'm right or wrong, but let's go through some real-world examples that might convince you about either the existence of magic or the existence of the ruling class believing in magic, right? You don't even have to believe in magic to know that they believe in magic. Now, a lot of these examples are pulled from Peter Lavenda's series Sinister Forces, though I will elaborate on them. You ever hear about this guy? Giordano Bruno? Giordano Bruno was a Dominican friar, perhaps today best known for his astronomy, which built on Copernican discoveries, right? He was also a hermetic occultist. Bruno wrote a work called De Viniculis, which is to say, of the link, and Peter Lavenda calls it a virtual operating manual for consensus reality. While it appears on its face to be an introduction to the method of conjuring demons, it is also a guide to psychological warfare, probably the earliest ever written. Giordano Bruno's works were studied by a professor at the University of Chicago, Professor Ion Culianu, who showed that Giordano Bruno had developed a magical system of secret links and correspondences between objects and events that are applicable to mind control and psychological warfare. Now, this is very interesting because Professor Culianu was murdered in 1991. On the campus of the University of Chicago. He was shot by a 25 caliber pistol in a bathroom on campus. It is very likely that Culianu was murdered by the fascist Romanian Iron Guard for criticizing the Ilescu regime. He was an expat Romanian, if I didn't mention. Now, chances are, if you're a premium subscriber, a serial chiller, you are probably not going to be an obnoxious skeptic, But I could imagine one of you, my dear reasonable listeners, saying, "But Jimmy, this Renaissance science stuff, it's all interesting, but it doesn't prove anything per se." And I would agree with you, but no less than Charles Manson, who was nearly illiterate, had declared himself the reincarnation of Giordano Bruno. Of all the people he could have picked, like, where could he have gotten Giordano Bruno's name? To me, this shows that either Charles Manson or his handler had a strong knowledge of high ceremonial magic to pull Giordano Bruno, of all people, out of a hat to be Charles Manson's past life. And Giordano Bruno continues to be relevant, as there was a student in Brazil named Bruno Borges who disappeared in 2017. He left behind a locked room with 14 books of encrypted text and a large statue of Giordano Bruno. Seriously, look up some of these images of this Bruno Borges room. It's remarkable. Borges disappeared for about 5 months and eventually returned home. In retrospect, this appears to have been a publicity stunt to drive sales of his books, which is what the police decided. The whole Bruno Borges affair also had some Cicada 3301 ties, if that weren't enough. Still, there are more examples of magic being promoted at rather high levels. For example, there's John Dee, who was the Elizabethan astronomer, mathematician, magician, alchemist, and occultist. He had a very long and interesting career, but one of the things that he did was he obtained an Aztec relic, an obsidian mirror brought back from the New World by conquistadors. A very interesting thing to do very early on in the discovery of the New World, like in Elizabethan England, like to get an Aztec black mirror, right? Now, it was said that the Aztecs were using this mirror to scry, which is a form of divination, and that's what John Dee used it for as well. He had a whole system of divination and ways to contact spirits. Now, for what it's worth, when John Dee was alive, which is to say the 16th century, England was a relatively unimportant backwater kingdom. But John Dee was scientific advisor to Sir Walter Raleigh and to the Queen just prior to England's long ascendancy into becoming a colonizing world power. Now, a more paranoid person than me might suggest that the two are correlated, and it's undeniable that the United Kingdom is obsessed with magic. From Stonehenge to Merlin to Harry Potter, it's basically part of their perfidious national culture, right? Later on in life, John Dee got in pretty deep with a con man. John Dee went on to innovate and use cryptography, and John Dee ended up doing polygamy at the behest of the entities that he contacted. Now, Joseph Smith did scrying and other magical practices, and he was doing a lot of the same magic that John Dee was doing. Their lives have similar trajectories in some ways. This would be a great topic for a full episode, or perhaps several. But now I will move on to the second half of the question. The second question Oshin asked was, "And do you find the evidence persuasive to suggest that the ruling class or elements of the ruling class practice magic up to the present day?" The answer to that is also yes. I believe that elements of the ruling class practice magic up to the present day, both in and out of government. I'll take it one step further. I think that some of them even have a private religion, which I have elaborated, or at least touched on the idea in certain Twitter threads that I've made, but let's get into it. So, right off the bat, there's all the John Dee stuff, the Giordano Bruno stuff, the questions overlap. There's also an almost inexhaustible amount of history of various kings and monarchs who also did magic. But, prior to the invention of the scientific method, I think that a skeptic could just say, that was just superstition and bad science, right? So maybe let's limit ourselves to more recent times that the ruling class and or the government has done magic. So one that's quite out in the open is the magician named John Mulholland, who lived from 1898 to 1970. John Mulholland is known as the CIA magician. Mulholland went to Columbia University, always suspicious. He worked in his magic career with Harry Houdini, who was also a spy. Mulholland knew Gene Tunney, the boxer, which almost certainly meant that he knew William Stevenson personally, William Stevenson of the British Security Coordination. And then Mulholland worked for the CIA. And as far as we know, he did all kinds of things, like teach sleight of hand to CIA officers. During the Cold War, he was also paid by the CIA to write a manual on deception and misdirection. You can read it today, entitled The Official CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception. Of course, the title is a little bit cheesy, I guess you could say. The CIA generally doesn't call things the official CIA manual of X, Y, or Z, but still. Now, like Houdini, John Mulholland did not believe in psychics, and he spent a lot of his career exposing the tricks of fraudulent spiritualist mediums. He wrote many books on this, in fact. Exploring his life and works would also be a great episode, but we have to move on. Now, another country with a strong magical tradition is Haiti. Before the Great Slave Revolt in 1791, leading to the Haitian Revolution, a high priest of voodoo named Dudi Boukman held a religious ceremony. And it was this high priest of voodoo who gave the sign to begin the slave revolt. Then, hundreds of years later, Papa Doc Duvalier, the president of Haiti, I think it's pretty fair to also, you know, say dictator of Haiti, right? But Papa Doc was said to be a voodoo practitioner. He intentionally dressed like Baron Samedi, who was one of the voodoo spirits, and Papa Doc bragged that his voodoo magic slayed President John F. Kennedy, who was his enemy. Papa Doc Duvalier drove around Haiti in a black limousine with a license plate that read 22. And interestingly, 22 as a number has occult power in voodoo. And, of course, President Kennedy died on 11/22, which was considered to be a powerful combination of numbers. Now, it can be easy to write off Papa Doc Duvalier as a magic-mad Banana Republic dictator or something, right? But then you gotta remember that most of the Founding Fathers were Freemasons, right? And, like, did that just stop? Or, you know, is something like that still going on? I have heard of more esoteric things involving Haitian voodoo and the Clinton family, but I will have to hold off on that until I can research more. Peter Lavenda, himself both a spy and a magician, said, "As the men of the OSS, CIA, and military intelligence developed from the armchair scholars and academics that most of them were before the war years, into soldiers fighting the Cold War on fronts all over the world, they became, in a very real sense, magicians." Now this sounds like high-handed metaphor, right? But Lavenda, and this is why I keep reading him despite all of his susness, he found two documents that are about as smoking of guns as I have ever seen. In 1964, the Special Operations Research Office, SORO, S-O-R-O, this research office at the American University prepared a paper at the request of the U.S. Army. This paper was entitled Witchcraft, Sorcery, Magic, and Other Psychological Phenomenon and Their Implications on Military and Paramilitary Operations in the Congo. This paper brought occult themes and rituals in to be part of psychological warfare planning, which is to say that Michael Aquino was not the only freak in the Army Psychological Warfare Group. I mean, psychological warfare itself is the domain of freaks and weirdos, right? So Lavenda said, The paper was authored by James R. Price and Paul Gerardini. American University was no stranger to psychological warfare research, having seen the establishment there of the Bureau of Social Science Research, BSSR, in 1950. The BSSR was the scene of numerous studies of psychological warfare on Eastern European countries, and its African Psywar studies were underwritten by the Human Ecology Fund, an organization well known to researchers of government-sponsored mind control programs as a front for the CIA's MKUltra program. No, seriously, the Human Ecology Fund was MKUltra. Peter Lavenda found a direct tie between witchcraft, sorcery, magic, and MKUltra, apart from John Mulholland, who is held out as like the obvious magician tied to MKUltra. But it went deeper than just John Mulholland, right? So the specific paper studied the use of occult ideas and techniques by insurgent elements in the Republic of the Congo. The paper states, magical practices are said to be effective in conditioning dissident elements and their followers to do battle with government troops. Rebel tribesmen are said to have been persuaded that they can be made magically impervious to Congolese army firepower. Their fear of the government has thus been diminished, and conversely, the fear of the rebels has grown within the army ranks. Now, for me, I'm reminded of stories that you sometimes hear about rebels or fighters in Africa who believe that they are protected from bullets, which this is suggesting that perhaps sometimes those rebels are under the influence of a psychological warfare operation to make them think that they're impervious to firepower when of course they are not. This sort of bait and switch is also what Operation Wandering Soul was about. The surface level of Wandering Soul, which as a reminder, that was Michael Aquino's much vaunted program of flying over Vietnamese jungles, playing ghostly tapes that are supposed to be the sounds of ghosts and dead people telling Viet Cong to, you know, put down their arms and not fight, right? The surface level interpretation was like, oh, look, these are such superstitious people. And then there's perhaps the added element that this actually pissed off Viet Cong fighters into firing at those helicopters, thereby showing their position where they could then be attacked. That's what this reminds me of. There's always a lot of levels to psychological operations. It's always fascinating. But this study about the Congo, this was not some frivolous paper either. The study recommended that today's insurgency situation should not be studied in a vacuum, but should be considered as part of a continuum stemming from the pre-independence Belgian administration, the impact of Western culture upon African tribal systems, the circumstances of the birth of the Congo Republic, and the nature of the struggle for power within the Congo since 1960. And, mind you, this is a good time to talk about how well-meaning liberals who criticize the CIA will often do so allowing the CIA to save face, saying why the CIA just doesn't know the history of this country and they're just bumbling around. And if they only knew the history of the Congo or, you know, Vietnam, they would find a more nuanced way to, you know, carry out their operations. But, like, no. At the end of the day, if you have shares in a mining company, you're going to fuck that country over. It's not about ignorance. It's about material forces. You know what I'm saying? This study shows that they did study and understand the Congo. They just didn't care. They wanted to rape the land. Now, this study also looked in depth at the administration of Premier Patrice Lumumba. It goes on to examine his political machine, which incorporated African tribal culture, including manifestations of beliefs in magic and witchcraft. Which, like, I'm not condemning Lumumba or Africa for having you know, beliefs in magic or witchcraft. Lord knows I've said I believe in those things to a degree, right? Finally, I quote from the study to finish off here. A sound understanding of magical concepts, practices, and mannerisms is necessary for defensive purposes should they play any role or importance in an insurgency situation. Detailed studies of supernatural beliefs of specific tribes are limited. The secrecy inherent in most magical rituals presents a formidable obstacle to the outside investigator, whether he may be a scientist or an intelligence agent. Which, there it is, saying that for counterinsurgency, a sound understanding of magical concepts is needed. And knowing how much counterinsurgency this country has been subjected to, I refuse to believe that that is not an aspect of it. Which leads us to the next smoking gun. I would say perhaps it's less smoking than the first document that Peter Lavenda found, but it ties directly into the application of using magic for counterinsurgency purposes, right? Now this is still really something. I'm assuming that you, the elect, my premium listeners, my serial chillers, I'm assuming that you guys know what COINTELPRO is, but as a quick update, basically it was the FBI's series of covert and illegal projects conducted by the FBI aimed at surveilling, infiltrating, discrediting, and disrupting domestic American political organizations, like the Black Panthers, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and many, many other groups, right? If you're listening to Program to Chill, I'm assuming you have heard of COINTELPRO, but there you go. So, on November 21st, 1968, an FBI SAC, which is to say a special agent in charge, which is to say a supervisor of agents, one of these SACs, which, I mean, I just realized how Freudian and funny that is. Like, anyway. A FBI SAC in Philadelphia wrote a memo to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who should need no introduction, right? The memo states, "The emergence of the new left on the American scene has produced a new phenomenon, a yen for magic. Self-proclaimed yogis have established a following in the New Left movement. Their incantations are a reminder of the chant of the witch doctor. Philadelphia believes the above-described conditions offer an opportunity for use in the counterintelligence field. Specifically, it is suggested that a few select top echelon leaders of the New Left be subjected to harassment by a series of anonymous messages with a mystical connotation." A few days later, on December 4th, 1968, Hoover approved the strategy. This is where the famous drawing of a beetle with the caption, "Beware the Siberian Beetle," comes from. And there were other drawings and symbols sent to people to creep them out and do counterintelligence work to undermine the new left. Thus, we have documentary evidence based on declassified COINTELPRO files that demonstrate that the FBI's attitude towards magic is one of, you know, using it to stop political subversion. Then, of course, though no smoking guns necessarily exist, there are the many, many trust fund heirs who join cults, also coming to mind the Rockefellers and other old money families that were involved in the channeling of the Nine. There's the weird art collection and hints of esoteric magical practices in the Jeffrey Epstein case. I think there's more than enough to suggest that even if magic is not real, they think it's real. So for sources today, of course I referred to By Night in Chile. Then, of course, I drew on several of Peter Lavenda's books, like all three of the Sinister Forces books. I think maybe not directly, the Kenneth Grant book, the Joseph Smith book, and maybe the John Dee biography that I read. I'm not sure I actually cited anything out of it. Either way, thank you for listening, and thank you for giving me wonderful questions. Just tell people about the show. I will see you next episode, and God bless.